This BBC podcast is supported by ads outside the UK.
Hallo bei Heute Journal, der Podcast.
Helene, du musst näher ran.
Hallo bei Heute Journal, der Podcast.
Vielleicht noch einen Ticken näher.
Hallo bei Heute Journal, der Podcast.
Oh wow, das ist nah.
Na klar, weil ihr jeden Donnerstag mit mir und dem Heute Journal Moderationsteam ungewohnt nah an die Themen kommt, die die Welt bewegen. Na klar, Heute Journal, der Podcast. Jeden Donnerstag, überall, wo es Podcasts gibt.
Stell dir vor, 400 Führungskräfte in einem Raum und alle reden offen über ihre Fehler und Erfolge. Genau das ist die Manage Agile. Bei der Manage Agile geht's um New Leadership, Teambuilding, Future Work, Unternehmensorganisation und KI in der Führung. Hier wird berichtet, was wirklich funktioniert. Knüpfkontakte, die bleiben. Manage Agile, 11. bis 13. November in Potsdam. Auf manage-agile.de sparst du 5% mit dem Code MANAGE5. Alles klein.
Welcome to The Briefing Room with me, David Aronovich. The Briefing Room is the virtual space where a big current topic gets together with you, me and the top experts for 28 minutes. This week, Freedom Day beckons for England. But has anyone told the virus? The pandemic is not over, said the Prime Minister this week. And indeed, there's a big increase in infections. Even so, most remaining COVID restrictions are being lifted in England on Monday. Scotland, Wales and Northern Ireland are easing their rules at later dates. Is all this one big risk that we're taking? And how can we know? Step into the briefing room and together we'll find out. Last December, I recall, there were some very well qualified and sober people predicting that with effective vaccines being rolled out, life could get back to normal by spring. It's July now, and it didn't happen. Why is that? First up in the briefing room is Azra Ghani, Professor of Infectious Disease Epidemiology at Imperial College in London. Azra Ghani, why are we still in this pandemic?
Well, we have to remember that even though it feels a very long time since COVID came, we've actually only lived with this new virus for around 18 months, and we're still learning a lot about how it spread. So whilst we've experienced, of course, two severe waves, and we may well be well into a third wave now over the summer, the virus is continuing to mutate, it's circulating globally, and over time we'll gradually move to something that's more stable, but how long that will take is really very uncertain.
Now, along with quite a lot of other people who thought themselves well informed, I had imagined that when we got to this level of vaccination, essentially the threat to the NHS would be finished and we'd be out of this. And that hasn't really happened. Is a lot of that down to what we call the Delta variant?
It is very much due to these new variants that are emerging. So if we think back to the first variant when it first arrived, it was a relatively lower transmissibility. So this R number that we all hear about, it was somewhere in the region of 2 to 3. As we've gone through the Alpha variant and now the Delta variant, the virus has mutated in a way that it's become more transmissible. And what that means is that it can spread much faster and to a larger proportion of the population. And so in doing so, it's going to find all the gaps in that wall of vaccination that we've built up and likely get through them if we do let transmission go in an uncontrolled manner.
And getting through that wall essentially means that it could infect a very large proportion of the relatively small number of non-vaccinated people, and indeed might conceivably affect some of the vaccinated people themselves.
Yes, it's very likely to reach the unvaccinated people, but actually many of our older population that are at most risk are double vaccinated. Unfortunately, of course, our vaccines are very good, but they're not 100% effective. And so there may be maybe 5% that could be affected, that even though they've had both vaccine doses.
So in fact, what's happened is that the extra transmissibility of variants has derailed people like my concept of when the pandemic would end.
It has, but as we go through this, I think eventually we will reach a level where we will be able to go back to normal. The problem is it's very unpredictable. We're still learning an awful lot about this virus, and we have it circulating globally, which means that there are unknown threats that will continue to wash up on our shores.
Now, unknown threats presumably means new variants. Now, do high transmission rates of themselves mean that you're more likely to get a new variant, which could be even more problematic than, say, the Delta variant?
It isn't the transmission rate itself, but it's the amount of transmission. So I think the things we're concerned about, of course, if there are many infections in a population, and that's both here in the UK and worldwide, then the chances of these mutations breaking through are higher. But I think the thing we're most concerned about now, as the vaccines have started to roll out, is a mutation breaking through that reduces the effectiveness of these vaccines. And that can happen when you've got quite highly vaccinated populations, but you also have a lot of transmission ongoing.
Are we clear now about how effective the vaccines are, the various tasks they have? In the first instance, in preventing illness, i.e. getting it and becoming unwell, how good are the vaccines at that?
We have very good data now, and particularly even around the Delta variant, and that's been measured in the UK. So they're exceptionally good at preventing deaths and hospitalizations, and those are really in the 95% plus range. The impact in terms of milder cases is a little lower, and those are a bit more uncertain, so they could be in around the 60 to 70% range. There is also a protective effect against asymptomatic infection, those that don't have any noticeable signs of illness, and also in terms of onward transmission. So all of these factors together help us, but none of them are perfect, and there is always a possibility that we can get more cases occurring.
Now, there's been a report this week, which you were involved in, about a real risk to the NHS, which was, after all, the thing that propelled us into significant restrictions because of having both flu and COVID around at the same time this winter. How is that supposed to work?
We've learned, of course, a lot about COVID, but over the last 15 months, we've also put in restrictions in place that mean that other respiratory viruses, such as flu, haven't been circulating. And what this means is that we've lost some of the immunity that we've built up as a population to these viruses. And as we open up and resume our more normal behaviours, there is a risk that we could have a really large epidemic of both flu. We've mentioned another virus, respiratory syncytial virus, that has particular effects in young children, and all the other viruses we normally see. And if all of those things occur together, then that could put a great deal of pressure on the NHS.
We're more susceptible to flu than we were because we've had less of it.
Yes, exactly. But we don't know how susceptible we are. The other thing we don't know about flu is how it may have changed. It generally mutates quite rapidly. So we won't know how well prepared we are for the new flu virus that's emerging, and indeed how well the vaccines will work.
If we were to have a bad flu winter due to that and a coronavirus problem, we could actually have a severe capacity problem.
Yes, absolutely. I think that's the thing that we're most concerned about, and we therefore need to prepare for that. And now all the things that we've been doing as individuals in terms of wearing face masks, staying at home when you have any signs of illness or respiratory infections, washing hands, all of these things will help reduce these other respiratory viruses as well.
Anything that government can do to encourage us to do those things would, in your opinion, help?
Yes, absolutely. Those things are really important. And I think we need very clear messaging about what those are so that the public can follow them. On top of that, what we think will really help is having testing for these other viruses, because the symptoms that you get with all of these viruses are very similar. So we have COVID testing in place, but it would be helpful for people to know what other viruses they have and then be able to act appropriately.
So we're going to have multivirus testing?
And it's technically feasible. Those tests are available. There just need to be systems in place. We haven't generally undertaken routine flu testing in the past, for example.
Azra Ghani, throughout this pandemic, we've had to base our policy on models that try to forecast what might happen to the spread of coronavirus and subsequent hospitalisations. But how do these models work, and how difficult are they to make? Joining me in the briefing room now is Tom Chivers, science editor at unheard.com and author of How to Read Numbers. Tom Chivers, we've all heard an enormous amount about modelling the spread of COVID. Now, how does one go about assessing the accuracy of that modelling?
Well, I mean, it's an extremely complicated business. I've heard a lot about the Imperial model, which was the one that came out in March last year. And that obviously enormously changed the course of our response to the pandemic because it implied there'd be 250,000 to 500,000 dead. That understandably scared everyone. Now, we look back, was that model right? What does it mean for a model to be correct? I think we can say they were in the ballpark. There have been 150-odd thousand dead. So that really was the case that we were dealing with hundreds of thousands rather than hundreds or thousands. But the trouble is, we've got this very complicated thing. The model is itself an input into its own output, you know?
I don't know. What do you mean it's an input into its own output?
Fair enough. OK, so when the model came out, we were on one course, we were behaving in one way, right? The model comes out, it says, look, actually, if we carry on behaving like this, this terrible thing will happen. So the model changes behavior. If you do something like you're modeling, say, the solar system, use Newton's equations, you can predict it for thousands of years in advance. You can say there is going to be a solar eclipse on the 15th of January, 2555, whatever, you know, that won't change the output, won't change how the solar system behaves. But if you make a model of how humans behave, for instance, of the economy, and let's say you do make a model saying, look, the stock market will collapse in 2 weeks' time, and everyone then says, oh, God, the stock market's going to collapse, I better sell all my shares, then your model becomes part of the input to the output. Do you see? The model affects people's behaviour. It's reflexive, is the word.
Seriously, Tom, you're not seriously telling me that when they make these models, they model in the assumptions about the way in which their own models might affect things?
Well, I mean, you have to. If you tell people that this virus is terrible and deadly, and if you go to the shops, it's likely to kill your grandmother, then that will change people's behaviour. I mean, it is an unavoidable fact about these models that they are reflexive. So if we say, look, well, you said 500,000 people were going to die, but actually only 150,000 did, well, they could say very reasonably and would be right to say, well, yes, that's because the government changed its policy on the back of our model, and that's why fewer people died. It gets very, very complicated talking about whether these models were accurate. It's not entirely clear to say what that means.
Do the models also include assumptions about changes in possible behaviour or something happening, which are actually very, very difficult to predict?
Yes. I mean, for example, on the 19th of July, we're going to change the laws over mask wearing. Now, let's say you want to put that into your model. We want to talk about how effective someone wearing a mask is at stopping the spread of the disease from them if they have it to someone else. It's very hard to get good data on that. Maybe it's 30% effective, maybe it's 50% effective, maybe it's 70% effective. You know, these things are all realistic, plausible estimates. It would make a real difference to the output, how effective it actually is between those plausible estimates. More than that, though, you've got how many people will actually stop wearing masks when I personally probably won't. I think when I go into shops, I'll probably carry on wearing one. Will that be true of everyone? Will it be true of half of people? Will it be true of a quarter of people? I don't know. More complicated than that still, the government has said that, the national government, but, for example, the London mayor, Sadiq Khan, has said, no, actually, on TfL transport, we're going to still require it. You could model, everyone will stop wearing masks on 19th of July. That would be an unrealistic assumption in your model. There's a lot of inputs, and small adjustments to the model will give very different outputs because it's such a chaotic and complicated scenario, and you're modelling a lot of complicated inputs.
Right. That's not terribly reassuring, Tom. let's talk about what the models are telling us. Are they broadly telling us the same thing?
No. Each model has a range of outputs depending on which inputs are given. They're optimistic, less optimistic, pessimistic scenarios. And they range from many hundreds of thousands of cases a day to merely about 100,000 or so. The next question from how many cases there are a day is how many of those cases will translate into hospitalizations and how many of those will translate into deaths. And there is a very, very wide spread. I've seen estimates going up as high as thousands of deaths again a day, like there was in the January peak, and others that go to below 100, I think. So let me narrow that down to say, not merely are all the models not saying the same thing. Each model is giving very different outputs depending on which input you choose.
Do we have any useful models for something like long COVID?
No, I'm extremely confused by long COVID. It's very hard to tease out whether there is something that is over and above just the damage you would expect from someone getting very ill to some really long-term brain fog thing that they're all talking about, which is comparable, I think, to CFS and ME, you know, the
chronic fatigue syndrome.
Yeah. And yes, exactly. We are still dealing with a disease that's a year and a half old, really. And the really long-term impacts of it, we just can't meaningfully model at this stage, I don't think.
Well, what I suppose I want to know is whether something like daily infection rates matter quite as much as they did if those infection rates don't necessarily lead to hospitalisation. And I suppose even further on that, Tom, if hospitalisation is a different sort of a thing with a vaccinated population to what it was before, in other words, people are in for less long, it's less serious, can we tell anything about that?
If you look back at the January peak, there was a rolling 7-day average of about 60,000 cases a day. And that translated to about 7% of people who tested positive ended up in hospital, and about 30% of them, or about 2% of the total, ended up dying. Now, instead of about 7% of cases ending up in hospital, it's now only about 2.5%, and instead of about 30% of hospitalizations ending up dead, only about 12% too. So there has been a big change there. So yes, I think we can detect a real vaccine effect there.
Is the vaccine effect big enough to stop you actually having quite a few people dying in a few weeks' time?
That is an excellent question. And if we look at the ratio now, it's about 0.3% of number of people getting cases are dying. Now, people are saying if there's going to be like 100,000 cases a day in the not too distant future, which is certainly highly plausible, then that would still translate to about 300 people dead a day. Hopefully, by then, there'll be better vaccinated population, so the link will be broken still further. But, I mean, 300 deaths a day is a significant chunk of the total number of people dying in Britain every day. So we would be still looking at significant problems for the NHS and certainly thousands of admissions every day.
Tom Chivers. One of the biggest unknowns in modelling is us. How are we going to behave? To look at that, I'm joined in the briefing room by Linda Bold, behavioural scientist and Professor of Public Health at Edinburgh University. So, Linda Bold, we're moving from this phase of government telling us what we have to do to one where we're now being told it's going to be up to us to use our own common sense and guidance. How do you see that playing out?
I think it's challenging. You're moving from mandating certain types of behaviour to a voluntary approach and asking for personal responsibility. And people will respond to that in different ways. There will be those that are just fed up and want to make their own decisions, those that feel uncomfortable and really are used to having that protection from the state, from government, and then those who might feel they want to comply with what they're being asked to do voluntarily in certain situations and not in others. So I think there will be inequalities.
In general, what has the biggest impact on changing a behaviour? Is it guidance, we really think you should do this, or is it legislation, state's view that you must?
It's really somewhere between the two, but it's driven by social norms. So what we see is that people, if they understand that they're supposed to do something, let's take seatbelts and smoke-free legislation as examples. You will have a group in the population who are early adopters. They either know the evidence or they understand the risk and they take up the behavior. Then they will probably encourage others to do it and others might take it up through time. But what happens when we introduce mandates for those kinds of public health measures is that increases a social norm. So in other words, people know they must do it. Therefore, a larger number are more likely to do it. And there's a disapproval really around those that don't. So it's not that we must say for everything we do, there has to be a law, but mandates or legal frameworks can improve people's ability to change their behaviour.
So are you saying that mandates create social norms more quickly?
Yes, that's certainly the case. And again, the two examples I've given of seatbelts and smoke-free legislation, you saw a big jump in people's ability and willingness to engage with those public health measures after they became legally required.
Is that also partially because people who want to conform and want other people to conform can, if you like, refer back to the law as a kind of ultimate arbiter?
That's right. And I think people do refer back to that. And I think it also makes it much easier for the shopkeeper. It takes the responsibility away from the business owner back towards the fact that government is requiring this and therefore citizens must do it. And I think people do respond to that. They understand it, particularly actually for measures that are not going to cause them direct harm. I mean, if we use face coverings as a really good example. Of course, there are examples of harms from face coverings for somebody who has experienced hearing loss, for example. But for the vast majority of people who can wear them, they're a relatively modest measure.
OK. Now, you're in Scotland, where there have been slightly different measures at certain points and where there are certainly sometimes different cultures from in England. Are there noticeable differences in behaviour between the two countries?
There's not a huge difference in behaviour. If you look at the different surveys, I mean, there might be when we now see this change in the framework, as in we are being asked by law to continue to wear a face covering. It will be voluntary in most places in England. We may see a difference. But throughout the pandemic, in terms of compliance with public health measures, there hasn't been a huge difference between the devolved nations. Wales has been more cautious as well, and England. Where there has been a difference, which I think kind of feeds into this, is in trust in government. And that has been consistent higher north of the border and to some extent in Wales than at UK level. And you could argue, even if the surveys are not showing much greater levels of compliance, there is, I guess, a greater sense of solidarity that's being channeled by government that people trust. And that may, I think, engender a kind of cohesive sense of we're all in this together and we need to do it together. And that may contribute to some of the compliance even beyond what's being picked up in the surveys.
It also might suggest that a kind of, if you like, a more locally dedicated level of government might actually be regarded as being closer to the people.
Well, actually, you see that internationally from studies that we've done in public health. If you have local ownership of particular measures, whether that be at the level of your neighbourhood, the communities that you live within, your municipality, even a region. I mean, you can see that within the UK, some of the regions that feel that they already have more autonomy and they're able to use resources more flexibly. So yes, I think it is a combination of people feeling that it's relevant to where they live. It's not coming from some distant government that they don't feel any connection with.
So do you think that something like Sadiq Khan, the Mayor of London, saying, yes, we will want to continue wearing masks on Transport for London, do you think something like that may have an impact in London, with Londoners saying, well, that's our local guy saying it, so we're more likely to go along with it?
Yes, and I think that goes above politics. I mean, there'd be plenty of people in London who don't necessarily agree with the politics of the mayor, but they may associate the value of Transport for London with part of the city's identity. I mean, it's a huge network that, you know, millions of people use. So it's an interesting question. Will it affect other behaviours in London, or indeed encourage other business owners who are now allowed to make a decision for themselves to say, well, yeah, in London, we're going to continue with the face coverings? It'd be interesting to see that.
Has something like mask wearing been established yet in this period as something that is sufficient of a social norm for people to carry on doing it?
What we know from the literature is what we've engaged in is relatively short-term behaviour change, which is easier than maintaining long-term behaviour change. You know, we know that from even things like weight loss and how much we drink, different public health issues. So in terms of mask wearing, there's two things I would say. From studies like the Office for National Statistics, which looks at these measures, you saw that the uptake of face coverings, you know, the vast majority of people saying they were wearing them where they were supposed to, happened very quickly, probably helped by legal framework, but also social norms. And that's been maintained. So we have done that for about a year now. But a year is not a terribly long time. If you look at Southeast Asian countries where face coverings are definitely a social norm, they're not always legally required. But because people have been doing that for a few years, they were doing it previously for other epidemics, and they've continued to do so. Whether a year is enough for us, I'm not convinced. I think the only final point I'd make on that, people who are older and more vulnerable, who I think internalize, personalize the protection of the face covering more maybe than others, they may continue it for longer. But I think we're going to need a wee bit more time to really have long-term behavior change in favor of face coverings in crowded places.
Linda Bold. Talking about mass behaviour, one of the noticeable things has been the fact that different countries facing the same virus have behaved in very different ways. We've decided to take the Freedom Day risk. What about our European neighbours? Thomas Hale has been tracking what's going on in other countries. He's Associate Professor in Public Policy at the Blavatnik School of Government in Oxford University. Tom Hale, is any other comparable country doing what England is doing on Monday?
England will really be breaking new ground on Monday in that no other comparable country has gone to such a low level of restrictions with A, this level of disease, and B, more encouragingly, this level of vaccination. So it is a bit of a new terrain. If we look at some comparable countries, we see others that have had similar levels of disease or similar levels of vaccination, but none that have had this sort of unique combination. So in Israel, for example, policies were rolled back when there was a similar level of vaccination, but much less disease prevalence. And now actually the country has begun reimposing some measures that were dropped recently around masks, for example, because the Delta variant has led to an increase in cases. In Holland, in contrast, we had a rollback of restrictions at the end of June, but at a time when the cases were quite low and vaccinations were a bit lower than they were back then than they are in England now. So they were about 53% of the population having had one dose in Holland at the end of June versus about two-thirds of the total population here in England. And the implication of that change in Holland was quite dramatic. We saw a 500% increase in cases right after the rollback went into effect. And now the country is moving to reimpose some measures. So again, a case which could be a warning sign. And the final set of comparisons I would draw our attention to is in the US, where we have some states that have pretty low levels of vaccination compared to England, places like Missouri, that are seeing big spikes in cases and actually reimposing some new measures because the rates of cases are getting a bit out of control. You have other parts of the US, like, say, New York, where the level of vaccination is quite high, similar to what it is here in England, which are really watching the example playing out here in the UK carefully to see how they might want to react as Delta begins to rise up there as well.
The UK has now fully vaccinated two-thirds of the adult population. They've had both doses. How does that currently compare with our European neighbours?
The UK is still toward the upper range of most European countries, but a number of European countries have, from a slow start, begun to catch up. The Dutch example I was mentioning before, at the end of June, they were behind where England was, where the UK was, but now have basically caught up. We're seeing that in a number of other European places as well. And I think the European Union average is probably something like a month or 6 weeks off where the UK is.
Okay, so they'll be where we are in a month or 6 weeks. Now, where are they in regard to the Delta variant? Because the thing that has sent our levels up of infections up dramatically is the Delta variant. Are they behind us on the Delta variant? Are they thinking that they will stop getting the Delta variant? Or are they just trying to buy some time and vaccinate as much as possible before they too are subject to the Delta variant?
Well, I think it's very much the latter. I don't think any country in Europe at this stage is thinking they will completely avoid the Delta variant. It seems to be already fairly prevalent across the continent. There are some places that are only sort of just behind the UK, places like Spain and Portugal, where we're seeing big rises in cases, mostly connected to Delta. Other places that hasn't taken off yet, Italy, Germany, where they're very, very concerned about the prospects for it growing and are, for that reason, maintaining some of their policy closures in place as the vaccinations get up higher. So I think if we look forward about 1 or 2 months down the line, we'll see places like Spain, Portugal will be very much following in the UK's footsteps. Places like Italy, Germany will be trying to avoid it, but a big question of whether the current level of restrictions they have managed to do that or not.
What are they doing in some of these other countries that we're not, in order to try and offset the effect of the Delta variant? I do recall reading somewhere that France was planning a policy of some level of compulsory vaccination.
Yes. So France has now said that, for example, healthcare workers will have to be vaccinated mandatorily, but also that people who wish to access certain events or services, go to, say, a concert, will need to have a vaccine passport. We've actually already seen these kinds of passports, not just for vaccines, but also for people, say, with negative tests or with evidence of prior infection that's giving them some immunity in places like Austria, Greece, Israel. And the other big change this week is the adoption of these kinds of vaccine mandates in some parts of China, where certain Chinese provinces are now saying to go into a shopping mall, you need to give us evidence of you getting some vaccine. So this is, I think, an increasing trend, and one that is very much driven by the fear of the Delta variant setting people, even countries and places that had done a good job so far, setting them back to an earlier stage, unfortunately.
Let's stick with a country like France. Is there any evidence that mandated vaccine, or even the possibility of mandated vaccine, is altering whether or not people are likely to go and get vaccinated?
Yes, I think it's already shown to have a pretty strong effect. The vaccine hesitancy is relatively high in France compared to most other European countries. But I think I saw just yesterday the number of people booking appointments through the French vaccine booking system jumped something like 200% right after Macron made that announcement. So clearly some people are going to be influenced by it.
Quite a lot of the debate about this in England has suggested that we are being notably less cautious than everybody else. Are there any areas where England is actually more cautious in our behaviours?
I think to date, England has been a little bit more cautious in terms of working from home, where that's been a strong sort of guidance and requirement across the economy generally, with a few exceptions. Those exceptions have often been higher in some other countries. That will, of course, change on July 19th. I think from July 19th forward, it's hard to think of any rule where England will be exceptionally conservative in its approach and mostly going the other way. So no, really, after July 19th, England will join a small number of countries that don't have any kind of requirements on wearing masks in public spaces. In Europe, I think it's only Iceland and Sweden who have a sort of recommendation level on masks as opposed to requirement. So, we'll be in a slightly new circumstance there.
Thomas Hale. So it's a risk, and others are watching to see how it goes, the way penguins do if they think there might be sharks in the water. My thanks to Tom, to Azra Ghani, Tom Chivers and Linda Bold. You've been listening to The Briefing Room with me, David Aronovich. The producers were John Murphy, Kirstine Knight and Ben Carter. The sound was mixed by Graham Puddifoot and the editor is Jasper Corbett. And if you enjoy this podcast, you might like other editions of The Briefing Room, which are all available on BBC Sounds. Last week, we examined the changing political demography of the country, what makes us vote the way we do. Previously, we've explored the government's EU settlement scheme, and we've looked at the threat from ransomware.
Ich bin Charissa und meine Empfehlung an alle Entrepreneure, startet mit Shopify erfolgreich durch. Ich verwende Shopify schon seit dem ersten Tag und die Plattform macht mir nie Probleme. Ich habe viele Probleme, aber die Plattform ist nie eins davon. Ich habe das Gefühl, dass Shopify ihre Plattform kontinuierlich optimiert. Alles ist super einfach, integrier und verlinkbar. Und die Zeit und das Geld, das ich dadurch spare, kann ich anderweitig investieren. Vor allem in Wachstum.
Jetzt kostenlos testen auf shopify.de.